This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
A'udhu billahi samil adhim min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alam tara kayfa fa'ala rabbuka bi'ad bi-ramadat al-imad allati lam yuqlaq mithluha fil bilad wa thamud alladhi jabu as-sakhra bil-wad wa fir'aun zil-awtad. I recited these verses from the Quran to remind you about the importance of history. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses history as a very powerful argument to remind you about the purpose of your lives. The purpose of life is to worship your Creator. Because He's so powerful, He's so wise, you submit to Him. You submit to His power and you submit to His wisdom. We are not more powerful than our Creator. We are not more wise than Him. Therefore, we submit to Him. So Allah, to make that very point, gives us examples of those who came before us. Those who lived and died before us. Allah talks about their achievements, their monuments. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about how they used to carve mountains, how strong they were physically, how sophisticated they were. And despite all that, they are gone. What they took with them is what they did when they were alive. And if people did good, the reward was and will be good. If they did bad, the reward will be bad. For that very purpose today, we talk about the Mongol invasions. We learn from our history. History can never be ignored. Nations, people, communities, societies that forget their histories are also forgotten. I request that you turn your phones off, especially those kind of ringtones. Sorry? A connection problem? Okay then, we leave it. Thank you for bearing. You know, you guys need to fix your aerials. Okay, so what we're going to do is, instead, we're going to use your footage later on, inshallah. So, people who forget their history are forgotten by history. Those who forget the history are condemned to relive it. Why? Because you don't learn any lessons from your history. History teaches you what was done right. And if it was done right, it needs to be repeated. It needs to be upheld. It needs to be kept alive. And if something was done wrong, then we don't repeat it. Because as Einstein said, anyone who continues to do the same thing to get different results is a fool. That's why we learn from our experience. That's why Allah talks about history so much in the Quran. Allah talks about Banu Israel, Allah talks about Fara'ina, Allah talks about the people of Ad and Thamud and other nations. For this very purpose, to learn from their mistakes, be wise. For that purpose, the Muslims more so today need to learn from the history. And we are a people, unfortunately, who have completely forgotten our history. Generally speaking, when we speak to Muslim masses, Muslim youngsters, Muslim elders, you go to a mosque, you speak to any standard Muslim and ask them about the history, they will have no idea. And I'm not exaggerating. I can demonstrate that to you. Right now in this very hall, if I ask you basic questions about your history, you will not have the answers. This is the catastrophe we are facing. Forget about all the other catastrophes we're facing, Islamophobia, xenophobia, hate against Muslims, disasters, catastrophes, okay, killings of Muslims around the world, whether it's Central African Republic, or whether it's Burma, Myanmar, or whether it's what happened in Christchurch a few days ago. I believe these catastrophes are happening because Muslims have not learned from their history. Simple. If we had learned from our history, we would be on top of things. People wouldn't hate us. People hate us because they misunderstand us. For that reason, we need to learn from our history without turning this lecture into a lecture on the importance of history and learning from it. I think that's enough. For those of you who are wise, who have some intelligence, and I'm sure all of you do, then you know exactly what I'm talking about, learning from our history. Mongol invasions, why are they important? Because they are important because they were one of the biggest catastrophes in the history of humanity. The Mongol Empire to date was the largest empire mankind has ever known. The Umayyad Empire was the largest until the Mongol thing happened. The Umayyads, the Muslims, were governing from northern China to southern France. This was a promise made in the Quran. We as Muslims have a belief that God promised the believers the leadership or the rulership of earth. This is exactly what Surah 24, verse 55 states. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وعد الله الذين آمنوا منكم وعملوا الصالحات ليستخلفنهم في الأرض كما استخلف الذين من قبلهم. It is a promise of Allah to those who believe among you that He will grant you succession in the land so long as you believe and do righteous deeds and do not commit shirk, do not attribute or ascribe partners to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah will give you rulership in the land, which is exactly what happened. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam dies in 632 CE, having overpowered the Arabian Peninsula, having brought the Arabian Peninsula under his rulership. He left his companions, his followers, who took the rest of the known world, in some cases by force, no doubt. Muslims conquered lands by force. They never forced a population into Islam. This is a very important distinction which Muslims must make. Islam was never forced upon people by force. The territory of Islam was definitely conquered by force. Have no doubts about that. And do not be ashamed about that. The territory of Islam was definitely taken by force. Why? Because Muslims wanted to do good. Muslims wanted to bring about justice. There were cases where Jews and Christians were inviting the Muslims into their lands to come and liberate them from the oppressive powers that were governing them, such as the Persians, the Byzantines. In Spain, for example, when Tariq bin Ziyad landed there, there are Jewish historians who testify to the fact that the Jews opened the gates of their cities to invite the Muslims in as liberators. We cannot be ashamed of our history. Our history is great. It is amazing. It is magnificent. We have to be proud of our history because there is nothing to be ashamed of. Liberating people from oppression and tyranny is great. It's a virtue, and this is exactly what Muslims are out to do. Why? Because the Quran in chapter 21, verse 107, told the Muslims that the Messenger of God, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, has not been sent except as a mercy for the world. This was the mercy manifested by his followers throughout the world, throughout the globe. So Muslims ended up governing land from northern China and as far as southern France. And this was known as the Muslim civilization, where universities flourished, where Jews and Christians lived together, where people studied free of charge in institutions. Al-Andalus in Spain, there was a golden age for the Jews, there was a golden age for the Muslims, there was a golden age for peaceful Christians. Muslims, Jews and Christians coexisted. Same thing was happening in the Middle East, same thing happened in the Ottoman lands later on, and then the Mughals came to power. That history is very unique in itself. We can talk about that another time. So the point I'm making is Muslim empire, if you want to call it that, or Muslim dominance of these lands brought about a civilization which lasted over 1,000 years. And within this civilization, scholars, poets, scientists, philosophers were produced by this civilization. So make no mistake, when people jump from ISIS to Prophet Muhammad, they have an agenda. They ignore 14 centuries of history of Islam. For a reason, there is a deliberate... When people equate ISIS with the Prophet of Islam, they say, well, you know what they do? Muhammad equals ISIS. They make a jump like that. Muhammad, have you seen a rainbow? Have you ever seen a rainbow? It's curvy, right? So what they do is, they ignore anything that's between point A and point Z. There is nothing between Muhammad and ISIS as far as these bigots, Islamophobes, Islam haters, politicians, journalists, people who caused the Christchurch attack, they are not concerned about what happened in the middle. It is your job now as Muslims to learn about what happened in between point A and point Z, to explain to people that no, what you tell us is a lie. The reality is that a lot happened in between. There were universities, there were philosophers, there were poets, there were intellectuals, there were science experiments, there was mercy, there was justice, there was coexistence. There were Jewish scholars produced in their thousands under the Muslim rule. And the Jewish scholars called that the Golden Age. And this is not propaganda, by the way. What I'm telling you is not propaganda. It is history, which academics affirm. This is exactly what took place throughout the Muslim history. So have no shame about your history and about your faith. What the Prophet ﷺ did was great. And his fruit is not ISIS. His fruit was the Islamic civilization, the Muslim civilization from China to Spain. And this was the largest empire the world had ever known. This chunk. The promise made by the Quran was fulfilled to the letter. The companions of the Prophet Muhammad and their followers eventually ended up governing land from China to southern France, and this produced a golden age for people who were living in these lands. There is a book I strongly recommend to understand what I'm talking about. Write the name of the book. The book is Preaching of Islam by Professor Thomas Arnold. The book is quite old. Academics don't like to use old books. But this book has some facts you can learn from. The arguments are not necessarily very highly academic, but the facts still stand. Preaching of Islam makes this very point, that Islam did a great job in bringing people together, in creating a civilization that directly inspired the European civilization, or Western civilization, what we call the Western civilization today. It is directly in debt towards Islam and Muslims. This is another lecture. Mongol invasions, please, coming back to Mongol invasions. So Mongol Empire was the largest empire after the Umayyad rule. The Mongols took land very rapidly and they created the largest empire the world has ever known. The Mongol record has not been broken yet. Even the British Empire was not larger than the Mongol Empire. The Mongols simply spread. Within a century, they had created the largest empire the world had ever known. So this was the territory Mongol took. Look how far they went. This is something you have to understand very quickly. They started from this region, Mongolia. They spread into China, they went into Tibet, they went into Persia, they took Baghdad, they were in Moscow, they went into Europe, they were in Poland and Hungary, Ukraine. They went very far. They took the world by a shock. The whole world was shaken by the Mongols. And the Muslims suffered the most. According to some untrustworthy estimates, because medieval estimates are always untrustworthy, unfortunately they can never be 100%. That's why there is such a vast variety of views on numbers when it comes to the Middle Ages. what happened during the Middle Ages, the number of armies, the number of men killed, the number of people who fell, the number of houses that were burnt, we can never be sure about the number. But there are some estimates that close to 10 million Muslims were killed in all of this region. All of this region, close to 10 million Muslims were killed by Genghis Khan and his progeny. This is a depiction of Genghis Khan, and he governed from 1206 to 1227. He was born in the region today known as Mongolia, and his history in itself is quite vast. We can do a lecture on him alone, which I won't do today. I will continue talking about the invasions and what caused them. Genghis Khan came to power in Mongolia. He united some of the Mongolian tribes. They were also known as Tatars, or Tatar in the Arabic language, okay, or Mughals in the Persian language. Later on, the Mughals of India were called Mughals in a derogatory way. You know, that word Mughal meant the Mongols. But the Mughals used to call themselves Taimurids, because they descended from Taimur, who was a conqueror in the 14th century in the same Central Asian region, which is another history in itself. I will be throwing a lot of things in the middle in this lecture, and if you want to research those things, you will have to go away and research them. I cannot possibly talk about all these things in this short presentation. So I will try my best to fit in as much information as possible, information that is relevant. So Genghis Khan, he united his tribes in Mongolia. These tribes were nomadic tribes. They lived on horse meat and horse milk. And even to this day, Central Asia, one of the best delicacies, like it or not, is horse meat. Do you watch Mark Queens? He watches vlogs. He was in Uzbekistan recently. By the way, do you know horse meat is halal?
Yes.
I've never had it. I wouldn't have it. But it is halal. It is halal. In Uzbekistan, which is a Muslim country, by population or demographically, it's a Muslim country, people love horse meat there. Mark Weems had plenty of it in those vlogs. So these people were nomadic people. They had a very simple lifestyle. They had a very tough lifestyle. And that tough lifestyle helped them what they achieved later on. They were battle-hardened. Their terrain was tough. Their lives were tough. They were very immune to cold and warm weather. And their battle tactics or war tactics were very simple. We will talk about them later, inshallah. If I don't, please do remind me during the Q&A as to what made them so successful against their adversaries. Why were they so successful against their enemies? How did they come to power so quickly? Why were people made of wool? Were Muslim armies made of wool who were fighting them? No. They were strong armies. But why did they not stand against the Mongol flood successfully? This is a question we will address later on. So he united his tribes and he had ambitions. But he could not imagine the achievements or military achievements he would achieve later on. He was a very cruel person. References are given to him to this day. When people talk about cruelty and tyranny and barbarity and killing of innocent people, people refer to Genghis Khan. For example, Iqbal, the Urdu poet, Muhammad Iqbal, very famous Urdu, Persian and Arabic poet, a genius who died in the early 20th century in 1938, he said in one of his verses, Juda ho deen siyasat se to reh jati hai Chengezi. Juda ho deen siyasat se to reh jati hai Chengezi. Who is going to translate that? Go on, impress me with your Urdu.
Say it again.
I'm sorry, I don't know any poetry in Pali language, so Yes, go ahead.
If the religion is separated from the politics, then Changezi is left as in cruelty of Genghis Khan.
Thank you very much. Iqbal said something genius. In one sentence he summarized the fruit of modern secularism. He said, if you separate faith, in other words, ethics, from politics, then what is left is the legacy of Genghis Khan. Because if you don't have ethics in your politics, if your politics is not ethical, this is a lesson you learn from history. Iqbal is teaching you a lesson through history. Juda ho deen siyasat se to reh jati hai Changezi. If you separate politics and religion, in other words, what you do with people socially, politically, militarily, this is all politics, right? What you do with people socially, politically, militarily, if you do not do it ethically, then what you have is the legacy of Genghis Khan. And nowadays, Hitler has been added to the list. Right? But Hitler was not as cruel as this man. He killed millions of people without remorse, as we will talk about it very quickly. Next one, please. So this is the Mongol Empire when he came to power. He united the tribes, he brought them together, and he said, let's make an empire. And the Mongols united under him because he was a strong leader, no doubt. He was an able leader, he was a genius in terms of military tactics and governing. So he brought all these tribes together. As you can see, this is the Mongol Empire. He brought different khanates. You know, khanate is like a rulership. You know, khan, the word khan, which the Pashtuns nowadays use in Pakistan, Afghanistan and other regions, as a surname or as a title, Khan actually means the Amir, the leader, the king. Okay? So Khan is a short for Khakan. Khan is an abbreviation of Khakan or Khagan, which is a Mongol word that means a leader. So these are different Khanates which were united by Genghis Khan under his rule. He attacked them one after another and he caused them to submit to his power. So he united them. And after this unity, what happens next is an attack on the Khwarizmite Empire. Khwarizm Shah, who was this person, I don't have a picture of him to show you. I have a coin, a gold dinar of Khwarizm Shah, Muhammad bin Khwarizm Shah the second, who governed from the year 1200 to 1220. He governed a large empire. Go forward, please. This is the Khwarizmite Empire when Sultan Muhammad bin Khwarizm Shah is governing. His name was Alauddin Muhammad bin Khwarizm Shah. Unfortunately, I forgot to bring his coins with me. I had his coins. I'm a coin collector. I'm a numismatist as well. And I had the actual original coins from these dynasties. Even the Mongol coins, I have some of them. Unfortunately, I forgot. But I have the images. So this was the empire of Khwarizm Shah. It spread to parts of Pakistan, current day Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Iran, and close to Iraq and Syria. Large territory governed by one man. And Ibn al-Athir, rahmatullahi alayhi, a 13th century historian. You're not getting bored, are you?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I have ways to entertain you. History should not bore you. If history is making you sleep, then you need a slap to wake up. I meant that metaphorically. Okay? Not literally. Because history is so interesting, it's so fascinating. The problem is the way it's taught, especially to your children. When you look at GCSE books on history and A-levels, I'm not surprised that kids don't want to study history anymore. Why would you want to study the appeasement theory? Right? Or what happened in the Second World War, or what Hitler was doing. It's important to know that. But to force children to study that boring stuff, you know, about the Second World War and other things like that, There is more interesting history. Teach them Roman Empire. Teach them about the Greeks. Teach them about other empires so people can take interest, children can find. And when you teach people history, teach them history with substance, with material evidence so people can touch and appreciate. So there's a reason why history is not taught the way it's taught, unfortunately. Anyway, coming back to that issue. So this was a large empire governed by Alauddin Muhammad bin Khwarizm Shah. And Genghis Khan, who was here in this region and beyond, wanted a piece of his empire. So he was looking for an excuse. He was looking for his Pearl Harbor. Yes? You know what that is, yeah?
Yeah,
he was looking for his Pearl Harbor. Or he was looking for other excuses to attack the empire. You know these tactics to attack targets in modern day and age, to find excuses to attack other territories is not a new thing. Don't think CIA and KGB and these organizations have invented these tactics. These tactics were used in the ancient period and during the Middle Ages. So what happened, to cut a long story short, some Mongol merchants were in the Khwarizmite territory doing business. Cut the long story short, they were killed for something they did. It is not clear why they were killed. And Genghis Khan sent emissaries to Khwarizm Shah asking for the culprits. Khwarizm Shah said, we will apply the Islamic justice. We will investigate and those who are guilty will be punished. Genghis Khan did not accept that solution and he attacked the Khwarizmite Empire. And when he attacked the Khwarizmite Empire, I'll cut the long story short, one by one, the attack took place in the year 1219. Remember the date. 1219 is the time when Genghis Khan decided to attack the Muslim territory governed by Sultan Alauddin Muhammad bin Khwarizm Shah. And at that time, Genghis Khan was already in his late 60s. He was already in his late 60s. And one after another, all of these cities were taken. First, Bukhara was attacked and the entire city was decimated. The details are far too grim and lengthy for me to go over. Ibn al-Athir, to cut the long story short, paid a tribute to the martyrs, to the Shuhada of Bukhara, and he said, my tongue trembles and my hand shakes in telling the story of what occurred. I wish I was not born to tell this story, but I must nevertheless tell the story so that people can take benefit. And he called it the obituary of Islam. That, you know, how would you translate the word obituary in Urdu or Arabic? Janaza? Sorry? Condolence. Sorry? Yeah. Basically, he called it the janaza of Islam. What he meant was the Muslims had suffered dearly. Bukhara was taken. First, there was resistance. And then, eventually, people surrendered. People were tricked into surrendering. The Mongols said, surrender and you will be safe. And there was ikhtilaf between the Muslims. Some Muslims saying, no, we must fight. We cannot trust these people. Others said, no, they are ethnically the same people. The Mongols are Turkic. So are we. We are Muslims. They are not Muslims, but we are the same people. Ethnically, they will not, you know, because even despite Mongols not being Muslims, there were certain standards the Turkic tribes lived by. So the people of Bukhara were under the impression that we will be treated differently by the Mongols. But they were wrong. As soon as the Mongols took over, they kept the population on the one side, and there was a group of Muslims in Bukhara who resisted, and they were besieged in the citadel. Eventually, the citadel fell, and Ibn al-Athir tells us the story that women were raped in front of their relatives, literally raped. And a lot of this has taken place in modern day and age. Unfortunately, when you read the stories of what's happening in places like Syria, you know, things like that happened in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. When wars happen, these ugly things do take place. That's why wars are not a good thing. That's why wars are not a good thing. This is what happens. So a lot of these things took place, and Muslims were systematically killed. Many people were enslaved, and some people were able to make away with their lives, and they took refuge in the city of Mosul, where Ibn al-Athir personally witnessed the refugees. He met the refugees. It is like someone like you go to Turkey and you see the Syrian refugees coming, having been devastated and raped and killed and injured and all sorts of things. So Ibn al-Athir saw all of that, and he was very disturbed by what he saw. The treatment the Muslims had received, the Muslims of Bukhara had received at the hands of the Mongols, was completely devastating for the minds of the Muslims who came across it. So Ibn al-Athir writes about it. He was alive at the time. He saw the very refugees, and he was the one who was one of the first people to comment on it. He was a contemporary of these events. Ibn al-Athir is a very interesting character. He is a very important historian for us to remember as Muslims. He outlived the Crusades. It is thought that he actually met Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi as well. And he lived long enough to see what the Mongols did later on to the Muslims. And then after Bukhara, Samarkand was attacked, and same things happened there. Catastrophes of a grand scale, absolute barbarity, even by the standards of the Middle Ages. People were ripped apart. In some cases they were pulled, you know, the Mongols would tie people with horses and rip them apart alive, and women's bellies were ripped open, and kids were taken out, and this is what Ibn al-Athir writes, and they were killed. So a lot of these things happened, and within 2 to 3 years, all of this region was under Mongol control. One after another, Merv was destroyed. The city of Merv, we are told by Ibn al-Athir that 700,000 Muslims were killed in this city alone. Over 500,000 people, close to 1 million people, according to Ibn al-Athir, and I don't believe the numbers. They may be, I don't think that's possible. But at the same time, a high number of Muslims, because it was a very important city. It was an ancient city, Merv. It was destroyed by the Mongols. Then Nishapur, it never recovered. It never recovered. Nishapur was destroyed. You know who came from Nishapur? Sorry?
Imam al-Nasai.
No.
Abu Dawud.
No. Who came from Nishapur? Imam Muslim. Imam Muslim bin Hajjaj Nishapuri. Remember, Sahih Muslim, yes? You know about Sahih Muslim?
Yeah.
Yes. So Nishapur was destroyed, never to recover. Herat, which is in Afghanistan, current day. So these are the modern boundaries. You can see that, these modern boundaries. This is Afghanistan. This is Pakistan currently. Okay? So all of this was completely decimated. Isfahan. All of these cities were taken by the Mongols within 2 to 3 years. 1219 when Genghis Khan came in, and by 1222-23 all of this territory had been taken. Now Khwarizm Shah, who was supposed to be fighting back, moved from city to city to save his life and his family and his wealth. He kept moving with his treasure and eventually ended up dying soon after. In 1220 Khwarizm Shah was dead. When the Mongol invasion was still going on, he was on the run, he died. His son, Jalaluddin bin Muhammad Khwarizm Shah, please go back. Jalaluddin, this is his coin. Jalaluddin Khwarizm Shah, who governed for another 10 years, also tried to fight back against the Mongols, but he could not be successful because there was division within the Muslim ranks. Muslims are fighting each other. Khwarizm Shah ended up fighting his brother, one of his brothers, and that destroyed his power. He was not powerful enough to fight the Mongols. Okay, the dynamics were very, very complicated at the time. The Muslim power was divided. As soon as the Mongols attacked, people rose and they started to claim power. They were fighting against Mongols and they were fighting against their own people. If the Muslims had a united front militarily, Mongols could never achieve what they did. It's not that the Mongols were invincible. They were humans. They were as humans as Muslims at the time. But because Muslims are divided, they kept fighting each other. There was no united front, and wherever the Mongols went, they decimated the cities, they burnt the cities down, they killed the population. This is why there are estimates that close to 10 million Muslims lost their lives from Central Asia to Syria within these decades. So Jalaluddin Khwarizm Shah could not successfully continue, and he was on the run, found by a peasant, told him his name, and the peasant found out that this is Jalaluddin who had killed his brother, and the peasant ended up killing him as well. So Muslims were left without any power. Ibn Athir states about Jalaluddin and his father that the reason why no one could help them is because when they were expanding the empire, they were killing all the kings they were conquering. Muslim kings, when they were expanding their empire, every Muslim king or ruler they came across, they killed him. And that's why there was no effective leader left to join them to fight against the Mongols. So once they were killed, the Muslims were left without leadership. Next please. So this is Ogedai Khan, who was one of the sons of Genghis Khan. He succeeded his father. He governed from 1229 to 1241. The empire is still spreading. The Mongols are still going on. There were breaks in the middle. The Mongols stopped at times for a few years, for example, to rest and to consolidate their power, and then they would reinitiate hostilities against the surrounding Muslims. And Muslims kept coming back to power and kept losing territory. So back and forth, you know, this tennis match between the Mongols, militarily speaking, and Muslims was going on for a few decades, right? Until the grand catastrophe took place, which was, if you go forward please. So this was Mongke Khan, who came to power after Ogedai, who was one of the most powerful Mongol Khans. This is one of his coins. This coin was minted by a Georgian king named David. This is a Christian coin, minted by Christian. But this coin was minted in the Arabic language, amazingly, and it was minted in the name of Mongke Khan. Okay? So, it was in his time one of the greatest catastrophes in Muslim history took place, when he was the Khan of the Mongols. Right? I cannot simply go into the details of each of these individuals. Ogedai, Mongke, each one of them, Genghis Khan, is a topic in itself. Do you all understand that, brothers? Right? Is a topic in itself. Khwarizm Shah, Jalaluddin Khwarizm Shah, the details of the battles and what they went through are far too many for me to cover in this short lecture. This is an introduction to Mongol invasions. What you are seeing right now are the main details or the main points you need to remember on this particular topic. If you want to read further, there is a book I recommend strongly, is by David Morgan. The book is titled Mongols. That's a good introduction, a slightly more detailed introduction on the Mongols and their rise and their, you know, conquests and their catastrophes and atrocities and what happened to them. So it was in Mongke Khan's reign, one of the grandsons of Genghis Khan, he was, that the greatest catastrophe took place. Hulagu, who was another grandson of Genghis Khan, was a general who was at the time in Iraq. This is, we're talking about 1250s now. About 30 years removed from Genghis Khan, right? Genghis Khan died aged 72. In 1220s, okay, and his children continued the onslaught because the father had created an empire and he had initiated the hostilities, and he had created an even bigger empire, having taken all this Muslim territory from Khwarizmites, right? Now his sons had to maintain it, they had to sustain it, and they had learned from their father well. They tried to expand, They had difficulties. There were divisions among the Mongols as well. Mongol Khans did fight each other for power, no doubt, but they continued taking territory because the Muslims were not getting the message even then that they needed a united front against the Mongols to survive, to protect the remaining populations of the Muslims. And the Mongols continued invading other territories. I'll talk about India. Do you know the Mongols invaded India, Pakistan? Mongols invaded Lahore. There were battles between the Mongols and the Muslim sultans of Lahore and Delhi. Do remind me if I don't cover it. Before I finish, remember to mention Pakistan, Lahore, and I'll talk about it very quickly. So, this was the greatest catastrophe, one of the greatest catastrophes in the history of Islam. The siege of Baghdad. Because the Mongols had been expanding, and they knew that so long as Baghdad is standing, they cannot possibly claim complete victory over the Muslim Empire. Even though the Caliph was he was just an honorary Caliph. He was, you know, a Caliph in name. He was like a puppet. And people would acknowledge his sovereignty over their kingship, for he didn't have any power in the real sense of the word. Even sultans in India, when they minted the coins, they would have the name Mustasim on the coin. They did acknowledge his spiritual sovereignty, his you know, eldership, if you like, right, in governing the Muslims in spirit, but not physically, right? So he was simply confined to the city of Baghdad and its surrounding area, right? Baghdad at the time was the largest city on the planet. It had the largest libraries in the world. It had the largest hospitals. It was a civilization in itself. There were many scholars there. There were many schools there. There were many, science labs there. There were observatories there. There were philosophers there, there were poets there were scholars there. Baghdad was such a huge civilization that the sophistication of Baghdad became a liability for itself. They became so sophisticated that they became too weak. How does that work? How does that work? They got involved with luxury too much. They were in fashion too much. You know, Louis Vuitton and Gucci, and nowadays, like, you know, Muslim men who wear these kind of things, yeah? Someone said, because you know what I'm talking about. Nowadays, Muslim men are very similarly doing fashion, you know? Like, they're very close to ladies. Very close to ladies. This is what happened in Baghdad at the time. Men were not really those men, leaders, thinkers, intellectuals, policymakers, far-sighted rulers. They were not like that. They had lost their sight. They couldn't see what's happening around. I believe as soon as the Khalifas of Baghdad heard that Genghis Khan is in, they should have taken some important measures to protect their people, right? But they were not doing that, unfortunately. They were still busy listening to their singing and dancing sessions. You know, drinking was rife. People were involved in romantic poetry. All these things are taking place. There's no doubt they were good scholars at the time as well, right? So this is the catastrophe that took place in 1258. Cut the long story short, Hulagu, one of the grandsons of Genghis Khan, decided that Baghdad must be taken if the Muslim Empire at large is to be subdued. And he besieged Baghdad. Before he did that, of course, he made many preparations. He carved roads between China and Iraq to make sure that the military, the army, can travel safely, comfortably. And he made sure there is plenty of pasture for animals. He, you know, all the strategic measures he had to take in order to subdue Iraq or Baghdad, he did that, right? And then he started to send out his spies to check what the military situation is in Baghdad. The military situation in Baghdad, unfortunately, was that there was a prime minister called Ibn al-Alkami, okay? And he was from the Shia background, And he was working with the Mongols. How do we know this? Because he was appointed as the ruler after the Caliph of Baghdad had been killed. Ibn al-Alkami had advised the Caliph to cut down the size of the military to save money. The Caliph, although he was a very pious man, Ibn Kathir praises him in his history that he was a very pious man, but piety is not always necessary for effective governing. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? A person who has a strong resort, a person who is an effective leader, is better than someone, for Muslims and their well-being, is better than someone who has a lot of taqwa, who doesn't raise his eyes and he's always has tasbih in his hand. You know what happens nowadays? People choose leaders who are the most pious people in the clan, but they might be the weakest in resort. This is something we don't understand. And you may ignore someone who appears to be not as strong religiously as the other person you have chosen. Imam Ahmad was asked this question. We have two options. One is a pious person, he's very pious, but his resort in making decision is weak. And the other option is someone who is personally weak, he has personal weaknesses, but when it comes to his resort to lead his people, he's very strong. Who shall we choose? Imam Ahmad, without hesitation, responded, you choose the one who is strong and his resort is strong. Why? Because his strength will benefit the ummah. And his weakness, personal weaknesses, will only harm him. Yes? It will have a personal harm, no doubt. But his strength will benefit the ummah. On the other hand, the pious man, his piety only benefits his person. But his weakness in resort will harm the ummah. So the Caliph, as pious as he was, because Ibn Kathir praises him for his piety, was weak in resort. He did not take the right measures. The army size was reduced. The Mongols came in. And then Hulaku, or Hulaku, was a very superstitious man. Some people came from Baghdad and advised him, do not attack the city, this is a blessed city. Anyone attacked the city was destroyed. So you will be destroyed. He was a very superstitious man. He said, no, I will not attack. Then there was another astrologer and an astronomer called Nasiruddin al-Tusi. Very famous man, also from the Shia background, advised Hulaku to attack the city of Baghdad and do not care about these superstitious ideas. Cut the long story short, the attack was done, many people were killed, and people tried to resist, and the resistance was naturally limited because the Caliph had reduced the size of the army, and there were many traitors who had joined the Mongols, including Muslims who had joined the Mongols to attack. There were Christians in Mongol army, Georgians, for example, Georgian mercenaries. There were people from the Shia background, Ismaili background, who were supporting the Mongol army. These are historic facts, by the way. I'm not trying to inflate some kind of dislikeness or hate against a particular community. These are historic facts. I'm only telling you history. My purpose is not to raise, because there were Muslims, there were Sunni Muslims who were in the Mongol army. There were Sunni Muslims, traitors, who were in the Mongol army, who were fighting against the city of Baghdad. So this is the point I'm making, right? It's very clear that there were a number of different people. So what happened? The Mongols eventually ended up entering the city and they started the massacre of the population. For 40 days, non-stop, the Mongol army was killing Sunni Muslims in particular. The Shia quarter and the Christian quarter was left alone because a large portion of the Mongol army was from the Shia background and from the Christian background, because Georgian Christians were there and the Shias were there, so they were left alone. But the rest of the population was slaughtered without mercy. Ibn Kathir narrates that a Mongol woman would come. This is how weak the Muslims had become at the time. A Mongol woman would come. She would line the Muslims up, men, and one after another she would be killing them. She would be executing them. And they would be standing there in submission, waiting for their turn. A woman, a Mongol woman would do that.
Alone.
Alone. Ibn Luthir also states that a Mongol man would come and he would find 100 men standing and he would start killing them, executing them. The Muslims of the city of Baghdad had become so weakened and so feminine that they could not defend themselves because of their fashions and their acquaintance with luxury and nice clothes, the nice curtains, the nice carpets, the nice chandeliers and fountains and all these things. These were civilized people, right? Fighting a barbaric clan, right? This is what it was. They had become so civilized. Are you listening? They had become so accustomed to ease and luxury that they could not anymore resist their executioner, someone who's executing them, right? This is how cowardly these people had become, unfortunately. Or another reason could be that they were completely terrified. They were terrorized. What they had seen with the Mongols. Mongols are scary creatures. And they would definitely make a point of driving terror to the hearts of people by committing inhumane atrocities. Deliberately, they would advertise their atrocities. They would magnify their atrocities for people to know that if you resist, this will occur. This will happen to you. So they would deliberately do barbaric things to the cities they have taken and to the people they are killing. So close to 1 million people lost their lives, including many scholars. And before this happened, Hulagu had asked all the dignitaries of the city of Baghdad to come out and meet him. Caliph came with almost 700 dignitaries from Baghdad. That included poets, scholars, intellectuals, businessmen, leaders, military generals, important advisors and the caliph. All of them were killed except few. They were kept alive. All of them were killed immediately. The Mongols got the hand and they... Can you imagine the cream of the crop they destroyed in this one day? Can you imagine how many intellectuals and how many minds they destroyed in one day? No one can imagine that. This was a great catastrophe. This was a huge catastrophe for the Muslims. And scholars killed within this particular group, people like the son of Ibn al-Jawzi. You know who Ibn al-Jawzi is? Ibn al-Jawzi is one of the greatest scholars in the history of Islam who ever lived. This is not Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawziyah. I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about Shaykh Abul Farj Abdul Rahman Ibn al-Jawzi, the author of Tilbis Iblis. Have you seen the book, The Devil's Deception?
Yeah.
Okay. He wrote the book. Ibn al-Jawzi was one of the greatest scholars who lived in Baghdad. His very son was killed among the victims by the Mongols. And many more scholars like that were killed in Baghdad. So Baghdad was completely decimated. Now a greater catastrophe, the library of Baghdad. The library of Baghdad, which was second to none in the entire history of humanity. The books therein were lost. You cannot imagine. I'm talking about even Greek knowledge was lost in there. Because many manuscripts belong to the Greek legacy. Many Greek works were translated into Arabic during the early Abbasid period, and they were still in this library. This library contained books going back to the time of the Prophet ﷺ. Masahif, the Quran, books of Hadith, possibly some handwritten copies of people like Imam Ahmad, Imam Bukhari, Imam Muslim. Some very important stuff Muslims had accumulated over the past 5 centuries was destroyed systematically. All these books were thrown in the river Tigris that runs through Baghdad. And the water of the river became black. It was black. And Mongol horses were riding on top of books. And they had no idea what's underneath them. They couldn't even save those books for their own development, for their own civilization. Same thing happened in 1492 when the Catholic monarchs, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, took the city of Granada from Muslims, the last stronghold of Muslims in Spain in 1492. When they took the city, they destroyed over 1 million books from that library. You cannot imagine what was in that library. I simply cannot imagine. Over 1 million works of poetry, mathematics, philosophy, hadith, tafsir, poetry, you know, you name it. You name the sciences, they had all of it there. So it is not the legacy of Muslims to burn libraries. Rather, the legacy of Muslims is to build libraries. If you are not building libraries, you're not following your predecessors. Let me tell you that much. If you are not book lovers, Muslims were the most bookly people in human history. Did you know that? Muslims were the most bookly people in human history. Today, Muslims have become the most bookless people in human existence. We have more interest in other things, cars, collecting stupid things, right? We have no interest in history. We have no interest in literature, reading, book collecting. We are more interested in other things. And that's why we are the way we are. We do not have leadership in universities. We do not have leadership in political circles. We do not have leadership, effective leadership. I mean effective leadership on the global stage when it comes to intellectual activity. We have all these problems. And this is because we have completely become a bookless people. We need to go back to books. We need to go back to building libraries. Despite what happened in history, we must continue. We must continue working for the betterment of this planet, to make this world a better place. You need books. Because if the books get into the wrong hands, then you get people like so-called intellectuals who are peddling hate against you, using books in the wrong way. If you do not read books, you cannot defend yourselves. You have no defense. Before physical defense comes intellectual defense. This is a battle of hearts and minds. You cannot win it without books. It is impossible. So we need to learn from our history. Mongols destroyed the entire library of Baghdad, and we have no imagination. We do not know what was destroyed in that library, unfortunately. Masahib, going back to the time of the Prophet ﷺ, and the 1st century, and the 2nd century, and the 3rd century, and the 4th century, and the 5th century, and this was the 6th century, and the 7th century, never to be recovered again. You cannot imagine what that means. I collect books, I collect manuscripts, I know what that means. I know what that means. When you lose one manuscript, when you lose one manuscript written by hand, by a Muslim scholar, or any scholar for that matter. So Baghdad was destroyed. This is a dinar of Caliph al-Mustasim, the last Abbasid Caliph in Muslim history. You can see his name there. Al-Mustasim Billah. And this particular dinar was actually minted during the siege of Baghdad, when Baghdad was besieged. This is a very expensive dinar. It was sold in an auction for a lot of money recently, because it was actually minted when the siege was still in place, because of the date. It is the last year of the Caliph. 656 is there. The date is there. 656 Hijri, in the last months. So what happened to the Caliph? Having seen the destruction with his own eyes, having seen the killing of his own children, his own sisters imprisoned, he was kicked to death. He was rolled into a carpet, and there are, according to some of the reports, he was thrown into a dungeon with his treasure, where he had gold and silver, and he was asked by the Mongols to eat that gold. Gold that you kept and did not spend on military development. Gold that you kept and did not spend on army, eat it now. I don't know how authentic these reports are, but there are reports that he was rolled into a carpet, a Mongol way of killing dignitaries, a Mongol way of soft death. he was rolled into a carpet and he was trampled over by horses or kicked to death. Al-Mustasim Billah, the last caliph of Baghdad, died in this way. Then 2 years later came a very good news for the Muslims. Again, cut the long story short, I think the lecture has already gone on for a very long time. I want to quickly talk about what happened afterwards. Mongols were a test from Allah. They were a trial from Allah. Call it a punishment for Muslim negligence towards Islam. Call it a trial, a test. It may be anything. We don't know what Allah meant to do. Allah's hikmah, Allah's wisdom is with him. Whether Allah was trying to teach Muslims a lesson, whether Allah was trying to change the course of history, whether Allah was trying to reshuffle because we believe in Allah's hikmah. You know, we are not like atheists that, oh, bad things happen, therefore there's no God. Actually, when something happens, you know someone exists, right? If you are in a dark room and you get a slap, what's the first conclusion? What's the first conclusion? There is someone else there. Do you understand? If you are in a dark room alone, and then you get a chanda, you know what that means, yeah? In the Punjabi language, that means a hard Pakistani slap. The one you, with a loose hand, yeah? You know in Pakistan when people fight, they slap each other. Before the punches, I'm trying to promote this part or this side of the Pakistani culture because I grew up in Pakistan. I used to see that very often. When people fight, the first thing that happens is a slap. People think that's feminine, but that's actually not. That's part of the culture, right? So, if you get a slap in a dark room, you know there is someone else there. This is what we say, that how we know that Allah exists is because of وَاخْتِلَافِ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ. Yeah? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Quran, Inna fi khalqi as-samawati wal-ard wa ikhtilafi al-layli wan-nahar la-ayatin li-ulil al-albab. In the creation of the heaven and the earth and the changing of the night and the day, there are signs for those who contemplate. So when things happen and your planet still carries on despite something like tsunami, like big earthquakes, big catastrophes, and your planet still continues, life is still going on. The sun is still shining, the moon still survives. There are earthquakes on the moon. People say, why are they happening? I say they are happening because Allah is trying to show you that this happens, and despite this happening, you still live. You still live. The one who created you, he gives you a shake, you know, every now and then. Wake up. I am the one who created you. I'm the one sustaining you, because any more of this can cause your life to collapse. You only get enough of a shake for you to realize, for you to wake up. So, in 1260, the Mongols are making their way to Assyria, and they had taken parts of Syria. They had taken the city of Damascus, and many Muslims had been kept. Captured. And what the Mongols would do very often is to use the captives to fight against the Muslim brothers. And if they did not fight against the Muslim brothers, they would be killed. Sometimes Muslim captives were used as human shields in wars. So when there's a war going on, there are arrows coming down, they would hold the Muslim in front of them so that he's shot. So Mongols had these very barbaric tactics. What were their military tactics? They wore very light armor. And in their clothes, they would wear a silk shirt, right? When an arrow would penetrate the body, they would easily pull out the arrow with the silk shirt, right? It would bring it out. So they had very genius ideas, simple ideas. They used shorter horses. It were the Mongol horses that enabled them to do what they did. These were some of the military tactics they had. They traveled very light. They rode very light. Other armies against them would come in armor, like with iron, big iron things hanging on them, and they would find it very difficult to fight. But the Mongols had certain tactics. They had charging horses with archers, something which the Mughals used later on, and they conquered India by doing that. Babur, the first Mughal emperor. A lot of these tactics were borrowed later on by other military establishments. In 1260, to cut the long story short, the Muslims of Egypt, who were governed by a people later on called the Mamluks, literally the owned ones, the possessed ones, because they were slaves who had become king, right? There were two slave dynasties in the history of Islam, whereby slaves became kings, right? These slaves came from Turkic background. They were very similar ethnically to the Mongols, right? They were bought specifically for one purpose. They were trained in military arts so that they can become helpers to their masters. Usually, sultans, kings would buy slaves and train them in military arts so that they can have their loyalty. Sultans in the Middle Ages, in the Middle East in particular, couldn't always rely on the loyalty of their own tribes and their cousins and their uncles. So for that reason, to avoid that trouble, they would buy 1,000 slaves, 2,000 slaves from Central Asian markets and train them in military arts. And some of these slaves would become so good that they become generals, and from generals eventually they became sultans. This happened in two places. One was Egypt, where the Mamluks governed, and the other place was, who knows? Go on, impress me. Impress me with your history.
Syria.
A place very far from Egypt and Syria.
Pakistan.
Yeah, that's quite far.
China.
India.
India.
The Delhi Sultanate. I said it first. The Delhi Sultanate, which consisted of entirely of slaves governing as kings. Very powerful monarchs governed from the year 1200 onwards. And they remained in power in some shape or another until 1526, when the Mughals came in. When Mughals came in and removed the slave dynasty from power. So the last slave dynasty in India was the Lodi dynasty. And the first powerful king of the slave dynasty in India was a man called Qutbuddin Aibak. It's a very Turkish name. He was a Turkic slave, also bought from Central Asian markets and trained in military arts, who, after the death of his master, who was Shahabuddin Ghori, Muhammad bin Sam Shahabuddin Ghori, who had fought many major battles in northern India against some Hindu kings, when he died, and you know where he's buried? Who's from Gujar Khan here? Mirpur? Gujar Khan?
Yeah.
You're from Gujar Khan? Wow. You know, Shahabuddin Ghori is actually buried in your city. Yeah. When you go back next time, ask them, where is Ghori's tomb? They will take you there. He was killed there, he was buried there. He was assassinated in his tent. He was one of the major invaders of North India. Okay? And then when he died, his very slave named Qutbuddin Aibak came to power. This happened in 1206, and Aibak governed for 4 years, and he fell from his horse playing something like polo. He fell from his horse in Lahore, and then he died, and he's buried in a place called Anarkali in Lahore. Okay? Then came to power Sultan Shamsuddin Iltutmish, who was also a Turkic slave belonging to the same clan. He governed for the next almost 26 years, until 1236. Then his daughter, Radia Sultana, came to power for 4 years, who was a woman, the first woman ruler in the history of Islam in India. Okay? She was very effective, very famous, very well known. There are dramas and movies made on her. Her coins are very expensive, very rare coins. Okay, and then came to power another man after her, one of the most powerful figures in Indian history in those times. And now when these people are governing, when Iltutmish, his daughter, and the Sultan that came after, Ghiyasuddin Balban, when these guys are governing, the Mongols are invading India non-stop. They're invading India, and these sultans are fighting against the Mongols, protecting India. You know, when you hear this narrative on the Indian news in the mouths of Hindutva activists and extremist right-wing Hindu, in some cases terrorists, when you hear them on the news, on Indian channels, that Muslims, you know, they brought nothing but suffering to India, they decimated the population, they if the Muslims did not defend India against Mongol invasions, just one favor of Muslims, forget about everything else, forget about all the Muslim libraries, all the Muslim scholars, all the poetry in Persian, all the books written in Sanskrit during the Muslim rule. Audrey Trusk is a scholar who has written a book to prove this very point, that under the Muslim rules, when the Mughals were governing India, the Hindus and the culture and the language flourished. There was a Sanskrit renaissance due to the Mughal rule, right? So all of this, put it aside, one favor alone of the Muslim sultans towards India is enough for Indians to appreciate. And what is that? Resisting against Mongol invasions at a cost which was very, very heavy. To cite one case in particular, Mongols invaded Lahore when Sultan Ghiyasuddin Balban, also a Turkic sultan belonging to the slave class who had become the king of India, North India, and these were very strong, observant Muslims. They were very strong Muslims, these people. They had weaknesses, no doubt. They had personal weaknesses. They probably did drink. They probably did have their dance sessions and all that. That was part of ruling at the time, right? But they had very strong attachment to Islam at the same time. The Sultan had a son called Prince Muhammad, who was the governor of Multan. Who was the governor of Multan? Multan was a major center of Muslim civilization in the Indian subcontinent. So the governor of Multan was the very son of the Sultan Ghiyasuddin Balban, and Prince Muhammad was the Waliul Ahd. He was the heir apparent after his father. So he was given a message that the Mongols are very close to Lahore. They are attacking the city of Lahore. So the prince decided to confront them. And the information or the intelligence he was given was that there are 3,000. A zero was unfortunately missed. Okay? He had no idea. 3,000, baby job, let's go. So he went to fight the Mongols. Near Lahore, this battle took place. When he got there, he realized a zero was missing from intelligence. It were 30,000 Mongols, and that means a heavy force looking at the Mongols. He went with a small force to subdue this. He was besieged, he fought, and he was killed in battle. Sultan Ghiyasuddin Balban never recovered from this loss. He loved his son dearly, and he gave his own son to protect India against Mongols. If the Mongols were allowed to come to India, the history of India would have been completely different. Who knows, they would have destroyed every single temple, mosque, place of worship standing like they did everywhere else. But Muslims defended India against the Mongols. And in this very battle, there was a very famous poet present named Amir Khusro. Very well-known Persian poet who lived in Delhi. And he documents what he saw. He even explains and describes the Mongols, how smelly and disgusting they were. Their hygiene was bad, their manners were bad, and they were like not humans. They were like creatures from somewhere else. And of course, Muslims are very civilized, very clean, very civilized in their manners and their behavior and the way they did things. They saw Mongols against their own prejudice, you know. Muslims, because they saw themselves. So this is what happened in India. Coming back to the Battle of Ain Jalut. Ain Jalut, similarly, they were Mamluks from the same background governing Egypt. They had come to power coincidentally at the same time in Egypt. So there were two Mamluk dynasties, because this phenomenon intensified. Which phenomenon? Buying of slaves and training them in military arts. It intensified in the 13th century. And this was the outcome. The outcome was slave kings who became so powerful that they became kings. They became the sultans, right? So, in this case, the sultan was Saifuddin al-Quds, or al-Qutuz. Qutuz was actually sold into slavery, but he was not Turkic. But the man who supported him in the battle strongly was a man called Baybars. I'm finishing very soon. In the next 3 to 4 minutes, I'll finish it. I don't have a watch. Okay. Okay. So I'll finish very soon so that we can go to Q&A, inshallah. Because the problem is the information is so much that I cannot possibly cover everything. So Qutuz, he decided that he will confront the Mongols. Cut the long story short, he asked for the Muslims to support him. Many refused to support him because they feared the Mongols, or they had joined the Mongols against the Muslims of Egypt. Mongols were definitely making their way towards Egypt. Egypt was very rich, and the Mongols had their eyes on Egypt. And strategically, Egypt is standing between the East and the West. The Western civilization of Islam was completely in what? North Africa and Spain. And the Mongols had their eyes on that as well. They had no idea as to what's there, and they were looking to go into North Africa and Spain. So who was standing in the middle? Egypt, governed by Mamluks. Cut the long story short, Qutuz decides that he will fight a battle outside. He goes outside to fight a battle near Palestine, near a place called Ain Jalut. This battlefield was about 65 kilometers away from the very famous battlefield of Hittin, where Sultan Salahuddin Ayyubi had some decades ago, defeated the Crusaders, and the 60 kilometers away from the very famous battlefield called Yarmouk, where the Sahaba fought the Romans. So this place was very strategically chosen by Qutuz. He got there first, so he got the advantage of choosing the battlefield. And he had strategically placed his people. He deliberately sent a very small portion of his army to fight the Mongols first, led by none other than Sultan Baybars, later on, who came to power after Qutuz had been killed. Qutuz, by the way, was killed immediately after this battle, unfortunately, by his own generals. This is a dilemma. This is a problem we had faced throughout in Muslim history. This internal fighting and killing of effective leaders to come to power. So Qutuz was killed soon after, and Baybars came to power. Baybars was the man who eventually got rid of the Crusaders from the Holy Land. In 1291, he besieged the city of Acre and eventually took the city from the Crusaders. So in this battle, he sent Baybars forward. So the Mongols thought this is a very small army. So they came into the battlefield entirely. Ketbuga, who was a Mughal general at the time, he wanted to wipe out the Muslim army once and for all and completely decimate the entire. But Qutuz had a different plan. He had hidden the bulk of the army behind the mountains, waiting for the Mongols to come into the valley completely and then to shock them. And amazingly, when this was happening, Qutuz dismounted his own horse and he went forward fighting with his men on foot. And when his soldiers saw the king fighting in person on foot, they were completely inspired and influenced by this very action, and they fought hard. And the Mongols were, for the first time in their history, were shocked. And Mongols were not known for leaving the battlefield. They were not known for running from the battlefield. They were very, very difficult opponents. And Qutuz had then shocked the Mongols in this battle. Muslim armies came down from the mountains, and the Mongol army was completely uprooted and decimated, and they were on the run. And then another battle took place 20 kilometers away, where the Muslims were able to overpower the rest of the Mongol army. So, or such was the Battle of Ain Jalut. After the destruction of Baghdad, 1258, 2 years later, this battle took place in Palestine, and that stopped the Mongol advance eastwards forever. Mongols were not able to take Egypt ever. They were not able to take any more land in North Africa and, by extension, Spain. But they continued taking land in the East. And then later on, a lot of these Mongols and their children became Muslims. The very people who came to destroy Islam got conquered by Islam. And they realized that their ways are not better than Islam and Muslims. They became Muslims. Many powerful Mongol leaders embraced Islam, and having come as destroyers, they turned into defenders of Islam in the very next century, and they became very powerful rulers. Shaykhul Islam Ibn Taymiyyah rahmatullah alayh was born 3 years after this very battle. In 1263, Ibn Taymiyyah was born, and when he grew up, he saw the Mongols invading his territory. As a child, he saw what's happening. His father and his family migrated to the city of Damascus due to Mongol invasions from Harran, which is in current-day Turkey. So Ibn Taymiyyah had migrated to Damascus, and he grew up seeing the Mongol invasions and their cruelty and the barbarity. And later on, he himself was found on the battlefield fighting some of the Mongols who had become Muslims. One of the problems with Mongols was that because they were militarily and politically dominant, they, even though had come to Islam, had still allegiance to the ways of Genghis Khan. They still referred to his book Al-Yasa or Al-Yasik as an authority over them, right? And this is why some of the scholars of Islam, they said they're not truly Muslim, because they haven't actually submitted to Sharia completely. They don't really believe that Sharia is superior to Al-Yasik. They still refer back to the ways of Genghis Khan for inspiration and authority. Therefore, Ibn Taymiyyah and scholars like him fought the Mongols in the coming decades. And later on, Mongols slowly, gradually lost their power, and many of their, you know, cities and their territories that they were governing were either taken over by other Muslim kings or other Muslim tribes or other Central Asian Muslim powers like the Mughals and the Safavids, who came to power in Iran, and they applied Shiaism in the country of Iran. So I will stop here for now. This is Mongol invasions in a nutshell. This was still a brief history and introduction. The details are far too much for me to cover in a short lecture like this, and we will go straight to Q&A. Thank you so much for listening. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.